This is special programming from North State Public Radio. It's been 10 weeks since the campfire started. I'm Mark Albert. Tonight on After Paradise, PG&E faces staggering legal costs. California's largest utility announced it would seek bankruptcy protection. We'll explore what it means for fire survivors and ratepayers. We also check in with State Assemblyman James Gallagher about the utility and the legislature's response. For decades, home prices in Butte County have been more down-to-earth than much of California. But with thousands of homes wiped off the map, Chico is now one of the nation's hottest housing markets. The deadliest and costliest wildfire in California history also took a deep toll on Butte County's sense of place. Some of the community are vowing to replace what they can. We want to hear your questions and comments. We've created a new forum where you can leave those questions, and you can find it on our website, mynsbr.org. For January 17th, 2019, this is After Paradise. On Monday, PG&E announced its intention to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The company faces multiple lawsuits over the Camp Fire and other fires from both 2017 and 2018. In a statement, it said bankruptcy was necessary to continue safe delivery of gas and electricity to its customers. NSPR's Tess Vigeland spoke with reporter George Avalos of the San Jose Mercury News, who's been following PG&E's finances.
George Avalos, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
What is in the PG&E filing? What does the company say about why this is necessary?
The notice that they gave on Monday of this week was, in effect, a warning that they intended to file for bankruptcy. And they stated simply that they don't see any real way out of their financial problem and to cope with the financial liabilities they've got related to the wildfires of 2017 and especially 2018. So their own self-analysis of their cash flow, of their finances, of their cash on hand, the revenue that they can generate will not allow them to meet those liabilities as well as make debt payments. In fact, they missed a debt payment on some of their bonds that was due this week.
And presumably part of the argument is also that, that they must have had insurance, but it's not adequate.
Right. They don't have enough insurance to even cover the fires of 2017 in the North Bay wine country. So this just seems to be, in the opinion of management, that there's no real way out without filing for bankruptcy. And it does not seem that the state legislature has any appetite at this point, according to some key lawmakers we've talked to undertake any kind of a financial bailout of PG&E to keep them out of bankruptcy.
Then, assuming that they do file in, 15 days, what does that mean for PG&E customers, particularly those who are now counting on the restoration of service to Paradise, Concow, and Magalia in Butte County?
PG&E has said it's going to keep the lights on. They promise that there's not going to be any sort of an interruption in service. But one of the key things to remember here, though, is that if they do file for bankruptcy and it's anticipated that it could be around January 29th, once that happens, in many regards, the fate of PG&E will be in the hands of a bankruptcy court as far as what the company is going to look like financially once this whole process is over, and it could take years.
Well, in addition to that, they're also currently under orders by a separate judge to make sure that poles and lines and everything else is in good and even better working order than it has been. But of course, that takes money. How does PG&E go about, A, continuing service, and B, complying with court orders while it's in bankruptcy?
Well, the way bankruptcy works is that it basically puts a freeze on any efforts to collect debts from the debtor. So things like interest payments on bonds, paying off liabilities related to wildfires, those sorts of things are effectively suspended until a plan of reorganization can be created that would allow PG&E to emerge from bankruptcy.
Over presumably a number of years, right?
Right. And so it's possible that things that, as you point out, that cost money, that would be up to the judge. But again, the last time they went bankrupt, the lights did not go out, the heat did not stop flowing, service was not interrupted. So the basics will continue, and presumably that would also include things related to some of the orders, possibly by the U.S. District Court Judge also. But again, it's not clear just how this is going to look in the interim, because every bankruptcy is different.
George, what happens to the multitudes of lawsuits that are currently making their way through, including those that have been filed over the campfire? In fact, Butte County filed after PG&E announced this on Monday. What happens to all of those? Where do they go in the pecking order in bankruptcy court?
I think the pecking order typically, once we set aside things like taxes, which have to continue to be paid, but typically the pecking order are secured creditors. Those would be the first to get paid. And then the next up would be unsecured creditors. But again, those payments and the amount of those payments have to be determined by the plan of reorganization. Typically in a bankruptcy, the judge's first priority is to make sure that the creditors get paid in some sort of fair manner. Now, of course, fair might mean that everybody gets 10 cents on the dollar, just as long as everybody is getting an equivalent and fair amount. Now, it might not be fair in terms of the original anticipation that you'd be paid back in full, but that is how bankruptcy works.
Well, given that lawsuits are still making their way through the courts, then people who filed them would not be creditors, right?
Well, they would be creditors, but, again, there is a pecking order, and the first group of creditors who get paid are secured creditors, ones that have some sort of collateral on whatever financing was provided.
So that would not be victims of a wildfire.
Well, I mean, they could be included at some point.
They could, okay.
But again, I have to emphasize that every bankruptcy case is different, and bankruptcy judges, while they do have great leeway, they do have to follow state law, which does lead to another point. The state legislature, according to State Senator Jerry Hill, whose legislative district includes San Bruno, thinks that this is an excellent opportunity, since the bankruptcy court has to follow state laws to get a law passed to restructure PG&E as a corporation, including possibly breaking up the company into two pieces to have a gas system and an electricity system under different public ownership or different ownership by investors. Break those up, as Senator Hill put it, restructure PG&E into two or more companies that have some sort of manageable and responsible approach to public safety and maintaining their system.
George Avalos is with the San Jose Mercury News. George, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Great. Happy to be here.
As we just heard, last year's PG&E-related tragedies have put wind in the sails of major reform pushed by some legislative Democrats in Sacramento. Potential bankruptcy and new laws could mean big changes for PG&E. On Wednesday, I reached out to Republican State Assemblyman James Gallagher, whose district includes Butte County, for his response to the company's bankruptcy warning.
It's really one of, I think, frustration and a little bit of shock. I mean, it's really kind of, sort of came out of nowhere. You know, there was no calls to us that this was going to happen. Certainly, our community has been dealing with a devastating fire that, we don't know what the cause of the fire is yet and who's liable. Certainly, there's been, some questions as that it may have been caused by PG&E equipment. So to all of a sudden declare that you're going to be going into bankruptcy when a lot of these questions remain unanswered and potentially putting wildfire victims at risk of, not being able to recover, that just causes a lot of frustration for people like me who represent them.
Isn't this really the public agencies that have lost so much, and also the insurers are going to seek to get repaid for the money that they've laid out to the fire victims? So it's the insurers and the reinsurers that are seeking, that could be left holding the bag by PG&E, or do the fire victims potentially stand to lose as well?
Right. Not necessarily, right? Because, yes, it's true that, for most fire victims, they're going to go to their insurance company and receive, compensation for, through insurance. And certainly many of the fire victims are signing up with FEMA to get individual assistance. But insurance doesn't cover, for example, loss of life. So for those who've lost a loved one, that's not going to cover that. You know, to the extent that there's liabilities associated with that, those victims would need to proceed with lawsuits against the party that was liable, right? And so, you know, insurance isn't going to cover that. And there's also people who are not insured. And actually, there's a lot of people who are not insured up in this campfire disaster area. How do they get compensation? And so, you know, to the extent that PG&E is liable, and I'm not saying they are, but to the extent that they are liable, we need to make sure that they compensate fire victims, and they should be first place. They should be way ahead of their Wall Street creditors. That's for sure.
For a long time, electricity was something very boring. It was a regulated monopoly. There was a push for deregulation, and that failed spectacularly. The Department of Water Resources was brought in to issue bonds to bail out PG&E. We've had the fires. What is the way forward? Where we go from here? And, you know, as a Republican, I would be very surprised to hear you say the words public utility, but what's the way forward?
Well, there's a lot in that, right? But I mean, I would start by saying certainly what we've been doing does not work. As a PG&E ratepayer myself, all we've seen is our rates continue to go up. We were the ones stuck holding the bag after the energy crisis in 2001. PG&E came out of bankruptcy at that time, and we, the ratepayers, are the ones that paid that money back over time. We, the ratepayers, are the ones that are picking up the tab for this big government renewable portfolio standard that has been placed on PG&E and other utilities. We pay that bill, but we, the ratepayers, keep paying, and we also are left with a system and infrastructure that is outdated, and because it's outdated, it's dangerous. Now, why hasn't PG&E been making the investments that other utilities have in Southern California, for example, to make it more wildfire resistant, you know, to ensure that there isn't the kind of issues that we've experienced? So, look, things have to change. And what I'm saying is, look, I think everything should be on the table. There should be strong consideration of a substantial reorganization of PG&E and or a breakup. You know, and let's look at what those options are and what's going to be best for wildfire victims and ratepayers instead of what's best for government and Wall Street.
The loss of some 14,000 homes in Butte County created a scramble for housing. And one of the ripple effects is that home prices are skyrocketing. The average sale price for a single-family home in Chico at this time last year was $341,000. This year, it's $100,000 more. This seller's market means people are doing whatever it takes to win bidding wars, including writing poignant narratives of loss and turmoil. NSPR's Crystal Smith spoke with a very motivated buyer who lost her custom forever home in Paradise.
Dear homeowner, we lost our home and everything we own in the fire on November 8, 2018, barely making it out alive with our three small dogs. Mike stayed behind to help evacuate the Feather River Adventist Hospital. Over the last 20 years, I have coached several youth sports, was a Girl Scout leader and a Cub Scout leader.
Billy Ariza and her husband know they were lucky to make it out of Paradise alive. Ariza grabbed her dogs, some medications, and their RV. 2 months later, she's still parked in a friend's driveway, where she wakes up each day and bids on homes for sale. To date, she's been rejected every time, even with offers well over asking prices.
It's definitely a seller's market. Sellers are getting far beyond the value of the home. They're listing them at a much higher price than what they were 2 months ago, and then they're getting another $100,000 over that.
Today in Chico, in our multiple listing service, we have 108 homes for sale, single-family homes.
That's Laura Burkhart, Ariza's broker.
Everyone's been through traumatic experience, so even just reading through the letters is a really difficult thing emotionally for both sellers and their agents.
Median housing prices in the Chico area are up over $100,000 from this time last year. Here's what Ariza would say if she could speak directly to sellers.
I would just like to see people start putting a priority on selling these homes to people who actually lost their homes in Butte County, trying to keep it local, trying to take care of our local community members, and to keep our community intact.
Even though she wants to stay close to her two children in Chico, Ariza is reluctantly expanding her search to Southern Oregon. For the California Report, I'm Crystal Smith in Chico.
You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Mark Albert. The heartbreak from the fire has tentacles seemingly everywhere. Not only did our community lose lives and homes and livelihoods, but we lost so much history as well. The Honey Run-covered bridge, long an icon of Butte County, is now reduced to only its steel piers. And Paradise lost an important museum. Laura Wenis has more on an effort to rebuild the past.
Okay, it's going to be a while until it's way down.
Inside the Coleman Museum in Centerville, docent Susie Bruns is winding up a Victrola.
I want the volume up.
It's a crank-powered, spring-loaded record player that's about 100 years old. The Coleman Museum is full of pieces like this, offering a glimpse into the cultures that shaped the area from the 1850s on. These items were donated by a community dedicated to preserving its history. But with the fire came a challenge to that dedication. The Gold Nugget Museum, the Coleman Sister Museum in Paradise, was destroyed.
We have, seems like almost the last remaining history. The Gold Nugget Museum was a big museum. It was just an amazing museum. And so all of a sudden, it's us. So it's so important that we just keep this history preserved and grow and share. Our children need to know about it.
The Gold Nugget wasn't the only cultural loss in Butte County. The Honey Run-covered bridge is also gone. For Robert Catalano, the president of the Honey Run-covered bridge association, the loss weighs heavy.
Look at any pictures of Butte County, you'll see the covered bridge. It's a place where a lot of people have gotten married, they've had their first kiss, you know, they've swam, gotten engaged. It's kind of a center of Butte County. When I first turned up Honey Run to come up here the first time, it's not like anything I'd ever seen before. I remember the S-curve, and I remember that, you know, the bridge used to be there, but nothing else was really recognizable.
It was an intimately personal landmark for many people. But for many years, the covered bridge was also an important piece of infrastructure.
Even the back roads still go up, so it's united the county since it was built.
So Catalano and others who are passionate about the area's rich history are determined to rebuild the bridge.
We started a rebuild the bridge movement, which has gone pretty far.
Their rebuilding effort has already raised more than $100,000. Community members also want to make sure that the Coleman Museum is preserved. Julia Westland is a board member of the Centerville Recreation and Historical Association, as well as one of the last students to ever attend the one-room Centerville schoolhouse that remains preserved next to the museum. She knows it may be a challenge to muster support for historic preservation efforts.
So we have probably the biggest collection around now, and it's going to be important to preserve it, but it's going to be tough in this interim piece to really keep this intact and afloat with limited community members living here because their homes aren't here.
But Catalano of the Honey Run Covered Bridge Association hopes that the effort to rebuild the bridge and keep the past vibrant will inspire displaced residents.
So there's hope. And what's really amazing, I feel that if we can do the rebuild of the bridge, then people will be more willing to stay here and rebuild their houses because they see that we're trying to take the infrastructure and rebuild it. And, you know, can't ever make something the way it was, but you can at least build alongside the people that are trying to rebuild their lives.
They won't be able to bring back the past, but it's clear this reconstruction effort is about rebuilding more than a bridge or a museum. It's about preserving the community's history for generations to come. For North State Public Radio, I'm Laura Winnes.
If anything good came out of the catastrophe last November, it was a renewed sense of community and a desire to contribute to the recovery effort. One example of that is a program called Adopt a Family, which matches fire victims with people who want to help them. NSPR's Tess Vigeland spoke with Eric Lofthom, who founded the ad hoc charity.
Well, Eric Lofthom, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
When did you start this Adopt a Family program and why?
We started it the Monday after the fire started. There was a friend of mine that had posted about one of his friends who had lost three homes in the fire. And I thought, well, I'll reach out to this woman. Her name is Jennifer Pruitt. And I'll reach out and just see if I could help her in any way. She said, yeah, she'd be happy to talk with me. And so I asked her how I might be able to provide some support for her. It was nine family members. And we ended up helping her. And then I have a lot of experience with Facebook groups. So I decided, let's start a Facebook group called Paradise Fire Adopt a Family. So we started the group to see if we could inspire 10 other people to do what my wife and I did to help this one family. And the group went viral. So we now have 34,000 people in the group.
34,000?
Yep.
Do you know where they're from? Are they mostly from Butte County or California or everywhere?
Yeah, most of it's Northern California, but we have people from all over the world. We have people, you know, people that are connected to Butte County or they're connected to the town of Paradise. Maybe they lived there in the past or the story just kind of grabbed their attention, it grabbed their interest.
Are most of these people simply looking for a way to give and perhaps, I don't know, not wanting to go through some sort of designated charity?
Yeah, I think what this particular story has really grabbed people's hearts to want to help because an entire town was wiped out. And I think that people are looking for ways to help people where it's not just giving to a charity. They want to actually get involved. And so we're providing a platform for people to connect with families that have been affected. And you can get on the phone with them and ask them about what they need. And you can go meet them if you're in the area. Go meet them in person and help them out.
What are some of the stories that you've heard so far?
Well, here's a real simple one. There's a lot of people that are displaced in hotels right now.
Right.
Because the housing is just so in short supply. And cooking in a hotel is a major problem because you don't have a kitchen. And so this woman needs a skillet. And somebody in the Facebook group went and got a skillet and brought it to her or shipped it to her. We've had people donate cars. I had a gentleman contact me the other day. He's like, hey, I have an extra car. Do you know of somebody who could benefit from a car? Well, so many of these cars got lost in the fire. So we were able to match that car up with somebody else. There was one family that we paired up with another family, and they went to their work and asked the work members if they would all pool money together, and they were able to put together about $2,000. That money was given to it was a dad and his two kids to help them out. So just all kinds of miracles are happening, and they're happening every single day.
For those who haven't seen the Facebook group, can you describe for us how this happens? Does someone simply post and say, I want to help, can you match me up with someone? Or do people come on and say, this is what I need, and someone says, let me get it to you? Because the logistics seem like they would be complex, but perhaps they're not.
Yeah, everything you just mentioned is happening right now.
Okay.
And in some cases, I'm involved with matches, but in most cases I'm not. People that need help, they go in there and they post for things that they need. They might need some gas cards, or they might need a ride to a doctor's appointment. There was a woman yesterday that posted that she needed a treatment for her pet. And it was a $60 treatment, and somebody stepped up and purchased that treatment. There's all different types of needs that are posted. People post their Amazon wish lists, and they'll put down different items that they're needing help with, or they'll post fundraisers like a GoFundMe. You know, people to step in and help out if they want to. It's not complex, because it's our whole concept is one family helping one family. So if you reached out to one family and got them on the phone and asked them to tell their story to you and said, how can I help you? And then they share with you, you're just helping that one family. So it really, it's very simple and it's very effective. It's really wonderful to watch so many people just step up. And, you know, in most cases, we're helping complete strangers.
All right. Eric Loftholm, thank you so much. And good luck with the effort as you go forward.
Thank you, Tess.
You can find details of the program and ways to help on Facebook. Search for Paradise Fire Adopt a Family. In the warehouse space behind Kathy's sewing vac here in Chico, a group of quilters has given away hundreds of beautiful quilts to campfire survivors. With shipments coming in from around the country, they handed out more than 900 in early December. Laura Flynn spoke to some grateful recipients and organizers about how the quilting community comes together for survivors of tragedies around the country.
Hi, my name is Terry Clary. I teach quilting classes at Honey Run. We are doing, through the Quilt Guild, a giveaway trying to give comfort to the quilters that and the community that have lost so much, and just give them a big hug with the quilt.
I'm Beth Carlson. I am a past president of Andy Star Quilt Guild, which is a quilt guild organization here in Chico. When the fire happened, because we were a little familiar with background of donating quilts to other guilds in areas where there had been disasters, we formed a task force, and we periodically are able to have giveaways of quilts.
One quilt per person, and then you can pick out...
My name is Linda Deesher, and I'm a fire victim from Paradise. Yeah, I lost my home and everything in the fire, yeah. So I have nothing. So a quilt would make me feel better, you know, so that's why I wanted to come.
My name is Sean Nichols, and we lost our houses and we lost our jobs all in the same day. So the one I'm taking is, I guess we'll call it blue and green and teal with some beautiful gold flowers and some wonderful lilies on there. I just think it's a beautiful piece of craftsmanship, and will hopefully make the motel bed look beautiful. So
we donated some to an event for first responders, so they took 100 quilts. We're looking now at moving into a group of teachers, quilters. We want quilters to be able to get started again or have something that they can enjoy, because we have traditionally supported the fire victims or fire survivors in Santa Rosa. We have sent quilts to Redding to support their group. We have guilds all over the country doing that for us now, sending us quilts for a giveaway. We don't always have enough to meet the need, but slowly we're making a dent and giving away a lot of our quilts.
And that's our program for Thursday, January 17th, 2019. We're produced by Sarah Bohannon, Phil Wilkie, and Tess Vigeland. Adam Ragusea composed our theme music. Our engineer is Matt Fidler. And don't forget, we want to hear your questions. Ask anything you want to know about post-campfire recovery at mynspr.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Mark Albert, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.